There are a number of factors that determine how well the algae that produces this toxin does any given year.
Paralytic shellfish poisoning is suspected in another death. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 22nd of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, pilot error is the cause of most plane accidents in the YK Delta.
For years, this area has been a training ground for lower 48 pilots.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
A Haines man died at his home early today after being released from a Juneau hospital that had treated him for symptoms consistent with paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP. It is the fifth reported case of PSP in Alaska and second death in 2 weeks. One expert says unusual conditions this year could explain the high number of cases. From member station KHNS in Haines, Tara Bicknell has more.
57-year-old John Michael Saunders suffered symptoms of the shellfish-borne poisoning on Friday after reportedly eating the viscera of Dungeness crab caught in Haines. He was flown to the capital city's Bartlett Regional Hospital for treatment. He was released on Monday and found deceased at his Haines residence early Tuesday morning. Jim Strader is with the Bartlett Regional Hospital.
What you would have when a person is admitted to a hospital, they're treated for symptoms. When the symptoms have disappeared, and they have seemed to recover and wish to be discharged, that's what you do. And his doctor discharged him based upon his desire to return back to Haines.
This was the fifth reported case of PSP in Alaska in 2 weeks. Saunders' cause of death is not yet confirmed, but if it is PSP, it would be the second in 1 week. Strader called the rise in cases highly unusual, and Dr. Joe McLaughlin, state epidemiologist with the Department of Health and Social Services, says the state is concerned. One or two cases of PSP are usually reported in Alaska every several years, he says.
We're very concerned about it. And basically, there are a number of factors that determine how well the algae that produces this toxin does any given year. So it has to do with the temperature of the water, duration of sunlight, and other chemical factors in the water.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks has monitored PSP occurrence in Alaska at least since the early 90s. Ray Roland is a professor of fisheries with the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. He specializes in aquaculture and marine toxins and says the poisons that cause PSP are 1,000 times more toxic than cyanide.
There's two disturbing incidences here. One of them is the five in 2 weeks, you know, but they're split between three different locations, Kodiak and Juneau and now Haines, and with different circumstances for each one. Which creates a real problem.
Roland suspects that it's a particular combination of seasonal and tidal schedules this year that could explain the spike in incidents.
If one looks at bivalve fishing, you know, clam digging, mussel harvest, or whatever, we could almost anticipate a late spring, early summer episode occurring. And it's not because of the toxins alone, but it generally is the first low tides of the year that attract people to go out and harvest shellfish. And so there's a much higher incidence of harvest and during a time of year where it could be dangerous to harvest. So you put the two together and you run the risk of having multiple episodes.
This is not the first time PSP has swept through Alaska. Peril Strait in Sitka, as well as nearby Poison Cove and Deadman's Reach, were named during a seal hunting expedition led by Alexander Baranoff in 1799. On that trip, 150 hunters died after eating poisonous shellfish. And a rash of related illnesses broke out in Kodiak in the 1990s. But there have been few reports of PSP in the state in the last decade. And before last week, no deaths associated with the poisoning since 1997.
Now all of a sudden it pops up its ugly head and we've got multiple episodes, which is not unusual for a toxin issue to happen because it is such a complicated process.
Paralytic shellfish poisoning is caused by toxins concentrated in bivalve shellfish, like gooey ducks, oysters, snails, scallops, clams, and mussels. But it's more uncommon to experience PSP symptoms after eating parts of crab. Saunders was the only person among several others in Haines who ate crab together who reported symptoms. Robert Presley is the Department of Environmental Conservation's seafood program manager. He says recreationally harvested bivalves are not safe, nor is eating crab viscera. But commercial bivalves and crab are safe to eat.
The only way it's found in the meat is certain levels can migrate from the viscera into the meat post-mortem. That's the reason we require commercially processed crab to be live at the time of delivery.
Saunders' body will be transported from Haines to the medical examiner in Anchorage for autopsy. The state began testing bivalves and crab in areas where PSP symptoms have been reported. Paralytic shellfish poisoning can occur any time of year, and cooking meat does not denature toxins. Symptoms include dizziness, tingling, numbness, and shortness of breath. People experiencing symptoms are advised to seek medical attention immediately. In Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
A federal judge today struck down the Obama administration's six-month ban on deepwater oil drilling. The judge said the government was too quick to conclude that because one rig failed, others were also in danger. But the ruling will not impact Shell's plans to drill exploratory wells in the Arctic Ocean off Alaska this summer. The Obama administration put Shell's Alaska project on hold after the BP disaster raised new questions on whether an oil spill could be adequately cleaned up in the harsh conditions of the Arctic Ocean. Curtis Smith is a spokesman for Shell Alaska. He says the court case is specific to the Gulf, but he calls the ruling encouraging.
What we saw, or at least at this stage in the courts, was an acknowledgement that not everybody and every project can be painted with the same brush, that we can do this responsibly, and that, frankly, the vast majority of operators are doing so, even right now.
Smith says Shell was a pioneer in deepwater drilling in the Gulf of Mexico and had projects there that were impacted by the moratorium. He says the company is hopeful some of those projects will now move forward. In response to the judge's ruling, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar today said he will issue a new moratorium on deepwater drilling with more information on why the six-month suspension is necessary. The White House says it will also appeal the ruling. If you live in roadless communities across the state, bush airplanes likely play a vital role in your life. They bring you goods and transport you to other communities. And while flying now is a lot safer than decades back, planes still crash and people still get hurt. There are many factors that can cause a plane to crash, but in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, pilot error is by far the most common. Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel has been poring over 2.5 years' worth of reports by the National Transportation and Safety Board. He has this report.
According to the NTSB, there have been at least 38 injuries in the YK Delta as a result of airplane accidents. That's going back to the start of 2008. Of about 22 accidents in their records, they have determined the probable cause for 18 of them. Pilot error is cited as a cause for 83% of those accidents. Not a surprising statistic to local aviation professionals. Bruce Perry is the instructor and manager for the Yukunvat Flight School in Bethel.
For years, this area has been a training ground for lower 48 pilots. They come up here. They lack experience.
Seldom does the NTSB solely lay fault with the pilot. Usually they say it's a pilot's decision-making in the face of adversity, like weather or some mechanical error.
Weather can be treacherous.
With over 30 years of aviation experience, Perry says Alaskan weather is well known throughout the industry as some of the toughest.
If you have Alaska time, you can go anywhere in the lower 48, and I think that's viewed as good time. In other words, been to Alaska for a couple of years, that guy's got some good experience and hopefully some better judgment.
The NTSB says that wind played a part in 5 of the 18 accidents, poor visibility in 3 of the accidents, and icing in 1. But they still attribute pilot error in most of those accidents. Perry says one of the things the flight school stresses, cautious judgment.
It's not good today, wait, and then go the next following day where the weather is better. Patience sometimes pays off.
Mechanical errors are also listed as reasons for the accidents in 4 of those accidents. But Perry said flying in the YK Delta is safer than ever.
I don't know. I've been out here about 30 years, and back then there really wasn't much. Nowadays, they have webcams in a lot of the villages, weather reporting in a lot of the villages. The internet is just priceless.
And landing strips have improved greatly from decades back. Also, Perry says that airline companies are improving safety by changing the way they pay pilots. They used to pay by the hour, commonly, but most now put pilots on a salary.
Which kind of helps, I've always thought, because then, you know, if you're getting paid by the hour, gee whiz, if you haven't flown most of the day and the weather picks up a little bit, you may be tempted to go out and fly just to get a couple hours of pay.
In 2008, a pilot died near Quinnahawk when he attempted to circle above a beach to check out a whale vertebrae. A wind gust rolled the plane, causing it to crash. It was the only fatality in the area since 2008. Perry says the seriousness of crashes has reduced.
That's nice to see, because it really, really is sad to see the fatal accidents, knowing that there's husbands, parents, wives, children that are going to learn about, you know, whoever it was on the airplane that died. And, you know, that's really tears your heart out.
Perry says the flight school in Bethel hopes to improve safety by retaining local pilots.
You know, the stability, and that's one reason the flight school was founded, hoping to capture the local population, the native population specifically, to train the people here in these conditions, and, that they'll stay.
I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an attempt to revive the Kodiak king crab fishery finds some hatchery success.
In the hatchery, we're achieving 20% survival, so we're increasing that survival rate 200 times.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
A geologist who was mauled by a bear near Rainy Pass Lodge is reported in fair condition at Providence, Alaska Medical Center in Anchorage. 54-year-old Bob Miller was attacked Sunday afternoon as he was walking to a helicopter picking up a Mill Rock Exploration Survey crew. The lodge is 125 air miles northwest of Anchorage in the Alaska Range. Lodge owner Steve Perrins says Miller remained conscious and even had a sense of humor as he was stabilized at the lodge for a medevac. The town of Elfin Cove is cleaning up after that big weekend fire that destroyed the Cove Lodge and Coho's restaurant and bar, displacing about 12 people. As KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports, local residents say it would have been worse were it not for the help from neighboring communities and the Bucket Brigade.
The Bucket Brigade really, really strikes home.
Deputy State Fire Marshal Bob Plum says Elfin Cove's firefighting effort is another example of how Alaskans pull together to help each other out. Plum arrived about 9 a.m. Saturday to the smoldering devastation. As he walked through the rubble, took pictures, and interviewed townspeople, the origin of the fire became clear, but not the cause. He says it started in the main building of the Cove Lodge in the center of town.
It was located in the lower building. It looks like in a wall assembly between their kitchen and the furnace room. And at this point, it's still under investigation. I don't have a definitive cause yet, but it's definitely not suspicious. It's an accidental fire.
Plum says it will be some time before he knows the exact cause. He's not ruling out faulty wiring, the propane-fired cooking appliances, or oil-fired furnace equipment. Elfin Cove is a boardwalk town with no roads or vehicles. The fire department has only 3 portable pumps on hand trucks that pump water from the harbor. The fire hose on Saturday stretched about 1,000 feet to the burning buildings in the center of the village. Before the blaze was out, at least 100 people had joined the effort. Longtime Elfin Cove resident Mary Jo Wild puts it this way.
Everybody was working in concert toward one end, and people I'd never seen before and will probably never see again put body and hard into this effort to first save what was possible and then to prevent it from spreading. If there'd been any wind, the outcome could have been very different.
Commercial fishermen in the area came to help, and just about everyone in town grabbed something to fight the fire. Extinguishers, garden hoses, some ran the small pumpers, but it was the bucket brigade that's made news throughout the panhandle. Fire Chief Mike Nelson says buckets were the logical tool.
Everybody here, since there are no roads, has a lot of buckets. We move everything with hand trucks and carry things in buckets, so everybody keeps them.
Nelson says the brigade began at the harbor, and a line of at least 70 people stretched some 800 feet to the burning buildings.
We were able to keep that fire knocked down enough for the hoses to be trained up at the higher fires. The people lined up and swung buckets all the way up. It was just amazingly fast. It moved as much water with those buckets, I would think, as the biggest pump was doing.
Despite that, Nelson says the town did not have the equipment to save itself. Relief came from its neighbors. Gustavus firefighters arrived before 5:30 a.m., followed by Pelican and Huna. All brought pumpers, hoses, and manpower, and the Huna crew stayed through Sunday, knocking out hot spots and mopping up. The fire chief has a message of thanks for those who made the trip to Elfin Cove to help out.
We didn't have the means to fight this fire on our own, and things would have been way worse without them. I don't think they could have been. They would have been worse, and our thanks are heavy to them.
In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
University of Alaska Fairbanks researchers have successfully tested a new device for studying fish in the expanse of frigid waters off Alaska's northern coast. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The UAF researchers are developing a system that uses an underwater vehicle that looks sort of like a 5-foot-long torpedo with wings. The underwater autonomous vehicles, or AUVs, can move around slowly for weeks at a time, tracking fish with small surgically implanted transmitters. Andy Seitz, an assistant professor of fisheries, says the AUVs, also known as gliders, performed well in tests last month off the southeast panhandle near Juneau. The tests, or flights as he calls them, also racked up a series of firsts.
This is the first time a glider's actually been flown off of the coast of Alaska, and it's also the first time a glider's been flown to test the feasibility of using for fish studies. The gliders are manufactured in Massachusetts, and they've been used off of the east coast of the U.S. quite a bit over the last decade, but nobody's ever used them in Alaska, and nobody's ever used them for potentially studying fishes.
Seitz says the AUV's energy-saving propulsion systems could greatly improve researchers' ability to study fish over long periods of time. Seitz and other UAF researchers hope newer lithium batteries will enable the AUVs to spend even more time, perhaps months, underwater. Peter Windsor, an associate professor of physical oceanography and principal investigator of the project, says the gliders also promise to save huge amounts of research dollars. That's especially important when studying vast areas like the Chukchi Sea, where the system will be tested later this summer.
If you work up in the Arctic, which we will this summer, a research vessel up there can be anything between $25,000 and $100,000 a day to operate. And an AUV is $100,000, one-time fee.
The researchers hope the tests in the Chukchi will also prove successful and will improve their chances for more grants they'll be seeking in the coming year. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The state shellfish hatchery in Seward is shipping hatchery-raised juvenile red king crab to laboratories in Kodiak and Juneau to be studied. It's part of efforts to rebuild the crab fishery around Kodiak, which crashed in the early 1980s. Much work remains before any hatchery crab could be released into the open ocean. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
It hasn't been easy. The Aleutic Pride hatchery basically just killed off the first batch of king crab larvae they hatched from eggs obtained from fishermen. Ben Daly, a researcher for the Alaska Sea Grant-funded project, says all the examples the hatchery had to work with were on the much smaller scale of a laboratory.
We've had 4 years of experiments so far, and in that first year we kind of found that a lot of the things that they sort of worked out on a smaller scale don't really apply to hatchery culture in our case anyway.
The culprit was a bacterium that bred in the water with the crab larvae. The bacteria formed long filaments that then impeded the larva's movements and feeding. The answer was filtration to cut down on the bacteria and temperature.
We learned that when we warmed up the temperature, actually, it allowed the larvae to molt more frequently, which allowed them to shed their bacteria kind of covered shells before the bacteria really became problematic. So essentially just speeded up their growth rate.
And so the project went from poor survival to better growth rates than in the wild. In between, they had to figure out the optimum feeding regime for crab larvae. Daly says it's quite time-consuming to feed the larvae, less so for the juveniles. They also discovered they could raise the temperature well above what the crab larvae would normally encounter in the wild. This year, the hatchery has shipped 5,000 juveniles to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Kodiak, where experimenters will begin to analyze the best conditions for release and try to find ways to cut down on predation on these young crab. Maybe, Daly speculates, limited predator exposure would train them for the wilder conditions of the ocean. But at least for the larval to juvenile stage, the scientists now know they can obtain a far better survival rate for the crabs than in the wild.
In the wild, survival from hatching to the first juvenile stage is thought to be less than a fraction of a percent. And in the hatchery, we're achieving 20% survival to the first juvenile stage. So we're increasing that survival rate 200 times.
Come August, they plan to ship another 5,000 Red King crabs to the federal lab in Juneau. And if all goes well, some blue king crab as well. Those eggs were donated by Pribilof Island crabbers, and Daly says they are quite a bit more delicate than the reds. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Juneau's Jacqueline Johnson Peta has risen in her career to run the National Congress of American Indians in Washington, D.C. Her personal path to education and success wasn't easy or perfect. Yesterday, she shared her personal story. Today, Peta outlines the National Congress of American Indians' top goals for improving Native education. APRN's Libby Casey has the story as part of our series on Alaska Native education.
When Jackie Johnson Peta first left Juneau for college in Utah, she didn't feel at home and eventually dropped out. The food was different, the clothing, and she knows that's a common story.
How do we keep our children in school? I wasn't the only student who had difficulty transitioning. To be able to have a program that creates some mentorship, but also just some peer support to be able to make it through.
Peta's organization, the National Congress of American Indians, wants to see more programs established in colleges and by tribes to mentor young Native students so they don't get lost. But she says before teenagers even get through the door of a college classroom, they need support.
The first thing I think is important is for Native parents to be able to really realize how important it is before that kid goes to school that you got a plan for them to go to college.
Peta says in order for parents to get excited about college, they need to feel involved in their kid's school. That's both the school's responsibility to welcome them, and it's up to the parents to be more engaged in how the school is performing. She says they should think of themselves as consumers demanding a good service. Peta says one way to help families and students feel more involved is to bring Native culture into the classroom. Her grandchildren go to Juneau's Glacier Valley Elementary School, which recently added a Tlingit name.
And my grandchildren who go to school there were so proud to be able to be part of those who dance and sing and put that potlatch on to rename that school. I know they will feel differently about education because they feel like they belong.
Peta and NCAI are working on ways to reward students to encourage them and help them stand out among college applicants. She says other communities like Latinos and African Americans have done a good job of creating award programs for their star kids.
And the students are able to then build a resume of these awards that really you know, look pretty great when they're competing to go to certain schools.
PETA's organization has been front and center in the discussion about how to rewrite the national education policy to make it better for Native students. They recently sat down with the White House to talk about its education blueprint. She says NCAI's top priority is strengthening tribal control of education.
And that's really to be able to get the tribal governments involved with the education policies that are developed locally, to be able to get the tribal governments in coordination when it's a public school system so that they're actually part of the decision-making body, as other governments are around the school systems.
They also want to see better data on Native students throughout the country. So if a child moves from an Alaska village to Anchorage or the lower 48, her progress and growth can be tracked. NCAI isn't the only group pushing for reforms. The National Indian Education Association has been telling Congress what it thinks should be the top goals. President-elect Mary Jane Oatman Wackwack says they, too, want to see more tribal involvement.
Strengthening tribal education authority or department's roles over Indian education is one of those that, you know, it's multifaceted. It will allow for a lot of different innovative approaches, you know, from birth to, you know, college transition.
Oatman Wackwack says culturally based education, like Alaska's Native Ways of Knowing model, should be used throughout the country. She wants to see support for more Native teachers and incentives for all good teachers to live in villages or on reservations. She says they're more likely to stay if their spouses can get decent jobs and if their kids have opportunities. And Oatman Wackwack says when Native educators aren't available, the community can still get involved.
So where there may be a lack of Native teachers within the school, they can supplement that through having other reflections of themselves within the school, maybe not in a teacher capacity, but in another role where they can have a positive self-image of a Native person, a successful Native person within their community, and be able to interact with them.
Mary Jane Oatman Wackwack is Nez Perce. Neither of her parents graduated from high school. And she says NIEA's goal is to keep increasing the number of Alaska Native and American Indian students who do graduate and start down the path of successful careers. And she believes they'll be even stronger if they're grounded in their traditions, heritage, and language, and more likely to contribute to their tribe. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can also follow all of the stories in our year-long series on Alaska Native education. Follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Tara Bicknell and Haynes, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.